Mr. Mervyn, Reel 7. You just mentioned a 2-week training at Firing Dales.
It was away from the main camp at Strensel. It was away from Spit and Polish, if you want to call it. And we were living in Nissen Huts with a cork fire in the middle that was going heating. And every morning, I think there were 3 tunnel wagons of those biggest ones, and when they were by the wheel, just a wine or something, pile into them, and they used to take it from, I don't know if it was Sally Hill Camp or something. Then it was off the main, Gate Road to Whitby Road, you used to go down through Sands End, down State Bank, over the river, I think it's the Esk, and then up the twisty bank at the other side, and away along the top. And then we used to leave the main road and go on the moors, like, you know, road department stuff. And go over the moors, and then we used to pile out of there. And there was like a salt course and different things. There was one of those from the top of a hill down to the bottom, was one of those wires way up there. Hang on and go down. Yeah. If you don't leave, go at the bottom, you hit the tree, smash yourself up. There's a sergeant at the bottom, you know, leave go, and then we had to go and do some training with the stem, I suppose, as well. And it was like a little, just a little valley, and the NCO would say, right, walk up there with the stem, and you've got to expect anything. And I mean, it's a bit archaic now, and he was behind you, you couldn't see him, and obviously he was bending down and pulling a string and a target would pop up to your left, and you'd have to 2 or 3 rounds, and then it would go down. It's just as if you were on patrol and you're going along, and then another target would pop up, and you know, obviously you'd missed it, you know, a target would come up and you hadn't seen it, and that sort of training. And
that was specifically with the Sten.
Yes,
because you mentioned using the Sten for house clearance. Did you practice that?
That was the idea of it being made or whatever, because of the shortness of it. And during the war, I mean, we didn't have any house clearance to do in Korea or like that. It was not when we were living. But I think it was designed for, I mean, it was only effective at 25 yards, you know, 25 yards in, but after that, you know, can guarantee the kill, like, so it's not too far away, like, only 25 yards away, wherever the room, you can spear the room with a gun, like, and you know, anybody and then we did a lot of camouflage, they would say. They would show you how to put camouflage on. We had the tin hats with a net over. We had all the gear on the packs, and you'd have to show you how to stuff heather and stuff and twigs. Then you would have to go and lie outside. And they would have to say, right, well, someone's got to find you, or somebody come along and say, well, you can see him straight away, you know, there's some brass glitter somewhere. And, well, you can see the shape of your helmet, you know, you haven't got the camouflage properly. And there was that. And then there was map reading.
And this was at this 2 weeks?
At Strensel. It would be.
It would be.
You know, they used to take you out on the wagons and say, right, they would drop me off and give you a map.
And this was each day? Something,
something different each day.
Had you done any of this prior to?
No.
Going on this to yeah. this part of the training.
But you had lectures, you know, when I say lectures, they would show you what contours on the map, like, you know, if the lines are close together, it's steep, if it's, you know, and, you know, give you an idea from map references how to get it, you know.
And you'd had the lessons at Strensel?
Well, I, Strensel, usually used to wait for them for a wet day when, like, you went out to let a fine. Usually, you know, on a wet day, they would bring you in and give you some sort of lecture on something like that, you know. And they'd take you out on a wagon and drop you off fancy, like maybe we're about to come. Or another one is to have, I don't know what you call it, say you want. They would give you, you'd leave the camp and have to go to a map reference. And then you would make yourself there and say, go to the post office in the village, and there'll be a notice in the window or something. And then that notice would tell you to go somewhere else. And you had to, it's like a rally, you know, where you've got to check in and all the rest. And you had to go around and then come back to the camp. It was all the map where you can
pick the little clues up as you go around.
Yeah, right. And then,
anything else that you can think of that you did in these 2 weeks?
Well, night. We used to go out at night and do some night firing. Marching. We used to do quite a bit of marching. Not on the square, like over the middle.
Is this a route march?
Aye. Then I'd be running up and down hills.
Would you do this with the full pack?
Well, not a full pack, with a small pack and the ammunition pouches and maybe the water bottle and the bayonet and rifle.
What sort of distances?
Oh, 5 miles. Yeah. But we'd have you doing like section attacks. You know, let's say a section for that, I think what we've done, a section for Vietnam. And you'd have to. You'd be a brain going in and another two on the brain and the last proper. And then the patrol, the section commanders, you know, the brain going there over to the left. And they would go over and then they would get down and say, like, if cold and fire out, you know, moved up the valley. And then when you've got so far, you would stop and get cold and fire out of the brain going. It was all in theory. And we used to do that sort of thing. And then, of course, as I say, do all these marches and make him walk up in the middle of the river. You know, just completely cussed and shit. you'll be, then he's hopping across this big stream, not a river, a big stream. And you know, he's looking for the steppy stones to get across. And you would say, well, you're trying to get your feet wet. Everybody get in and walk across the stream, get your feet wet. And that was it. Just for cussedness.
So this was a 2 weeks practical type of training.
Yeah.
Where were you staying at?
It was just about two and a half miles outside Whitby, on the Whitby to Gisborough Road. I guess where. And there was about, a dozen missing foots. It was not around the camp.
And who was there with you when you were there?
We took our own blocks with that, you know, but there was a permanent staff there who put the coal in the huts for you, or, you know, you kept the huts in there. And over the middle of the weekend, we got leave to go down, just on a night, down into Whitby, to put a wagon on, take you down to Whitby, and say, right, well, the wagon will leave Whitby at 11:30 to get you back to camp for midnight. And,
So it wouldn't be a very big camp?
No.
What were the Nissan huts like?
Well, I brought out the Nesca for the association weekend, it's still a bloody seal. That would change in 50 years, isn't it? The bare, the like a corrugated tin, half round, and the door's usually in the middle. And there's a stove in the middle, and that's about it, the beds, and maybe somewhere to put the clothes if not, you just going to keep bagging the bottom of the bed.
So what was life like then during them 2 weeks?
It was rough.
What was a typical day like?
Well, you had your breakfast.
What time would you, was Revali for?
Maybe 6:30, 7:00, breakfast.
What did that consist of?
Right. I think it was porridge, and then bacon and egg, and they put the egg and the bacon on, could turn the plate upside down and stick on the plate. It was very appetizing. And I suppose it was wholesome food to a certain extent. And then you would be given a packed lunch, or if you weren't given a packed lunch, wherever you were, the wagon would come with a tea, you know, to get some tea and sandwiches. Corned beef and onion or cheese and onion, and an apple or a pear for a sweet, and a cup of tea or something. Then when you came back at night, you got a dinner. You know, maybe you got a bit of soup, maybe some steak or something, you know. And then that was it. I can't remember what you were getting any supper. Because usually, because you've been up there, being on the Millers and the Heather, you would up your eyes and mud and for all you were, you still had a sort of wait when mud dried and push it off you.
Was there still inspections and parade?
You couldn't go out with a pair of dirty boots or with mud on your uniform.
And this was very practical based, so I would guess you would get quite dirty.
Oh, aye, you were dirty,
And you were still expected to clean up on a night time?
Oh, yeah. Clean your weapons. You should weapon inspection every night, especially if you fired them. And,
so you still had to clean and oil your weapon?
Yeah. You didn't get away with anything, you know.
And I guess there wasn't a great deal to do on a night time.
Right. By the time you'd run around them bloody mowers, then you'd come back and your socks and your boots are wet and you're all trying to get around this coat thing and then you get warm and dry your clothes off. But there wasn't any central heat to put them over radiators to dry. Sometimes it was a little windy, you might string a line of outside and try and get them blown in the wind to dry up.
So it was more basic than strength.
It was very basic. Oh, yeah, it was to toughen you up with, to give you an idea of what it was like.
What were the latrines like?
They were all right. Obviously, in the camp, they were all right. They went to the park, and they were in the fell boots. The last day we were there, we all had to go and work for this farmer. So supposedly, to pay for the damage that we'd done to his dry stone walls, or maybe he's killed the sheep or something. I think it was just a racket, but that's what we were told, it was to pay for damage which we'd done. So it was, he was getting a hell of a lot of work to do on his bloody labour, and he was getting them, we were doing it for him for naught, you know. It was one of those things. Because I think even now, if a farmer has sheep running on the mowers, like a Vodafone, and the army, it was funny. We were going for a weekend with the 7th Battalion of Vodafone, and about a month before, we were having a meal in Havian at war. And there was a farmer sitting next to us on the top and said, oh, I on about the RA, he's pierced for twice. He says, it's just on the edge of Waterburn, we're all in it. He said, oh, we've gone up there to see them fighting. He says, knock a few sheep off for us, but yeah, get more money off the army compensation than we're at 2-7.
So you strongly suspected something, there was an ulterior motive for this. Did you spend any nights under canvas when you were there?
Well, we spent some nights out, but not, didn't pitch a tent or like that. We had those ponchos, which, call them a poncho, which is like a big oblong thing with a whole end of it to your head. Put your head through and your arms, then it was press buttoned down and you clipped it so you covered. And the idea was if you could clip two together. And the two blocks went out the same together. But if you were just doing on and off, guard on and off, one could get out, one could get in, and get a ground sheet and one over the top.
What was the idea of the night exercises?
Well, I mean, when we were in Korea, the only time we did was fight at night. We didn't do any during the day, we might have fight during the day, during the night shift. I suppose you had to look right. You learned how to do patrols, you learned how to keep quiet. Initially, the training all the time was training you, okay, we're going to Korea. Now, a lot of the lads would have to go up there, were in the coins. near what they want to in Malaya. But they'll still have like the patrols to do and learn how to live out rough. And they would, I told you they had a shorter rifle for in the jungle. And they would use that. And it was just getting tough, but normally in the jungle line, I think they'd go all the time. But night time you had to go out passive before you had to get used to finding landmarks in the dark. And finding, I mean, there's always an NCO or corporal or something, they would know the place backwards because they did it every month or something. They would know everywhere they were, you know, they would have to map it. It's like what's going to be with the roads. They would just find the way.
So you were doing the things that you'd practiced during the daytime at night, the different method of moving forward.
Yeah. You know, I thought nobody got lost. You know, I mean, they always used to say when, if you're advancing in training, the minimum is 5 yards apart. That's what, if anybody opened the machine gun, you get one. But the two blokes on either side of them hit the deck by the time, you know, if you're spraying, if you come around in a circle, you get one, but everybody has to hit the deck. But if you bunch together, you can get two or three before you get down through the altar 5 yards apart, okay? And if you're 5 yards apart on a pitch dark night, you can lose the labour link. So you've got to use your discretion, like, you know, close up, or depending on how dark it is, or whether it's a moonlight night, or cloudy and dark, or kissing down the rain. That's it, man.
And firing at dark, in the dark.
Night firing. But, that was it. Yeah, I mean, they were always very careful that nobody got hurt, like, you know, even during daytime or night firing, you know, they were really good, you know, to make sure nobody got hurt. And, they were very safety conscious.
I suppose the night firing was this sort of covering fire. You obviously wouldn't be firing at targets.
No, well, you would put a tracer in, and then you get an idea of the traces, you know. There's got a lot of traces when I'm in Korea, and I suppose in the jungle, I have a lot of traces. Oh, you put traces to see where you touch one. And the best type of setting is at night time. It's same a bit during the day, but night time it's more vivid. And what they used to do, they used to have fits of blend one of one, what they call fixed lines. They would fix it up, set it up to a target, and just leave it set up, all set up, and then they would know that it was firing 7 foot above ground level. And as you were walking, they would fire it at you, and you would see the bullets come. But they know it was going to go over the top of you.
Coming towards you.
But you don't, you know.
What did you think of that? Was this your first time under fire?
You know, that's to give you the...
Give you an idea of what it's like.
What it's like, you know. I mean, you know, the day with you on the day... That's what I call firing on fixed lines. And I mean, you do this... They tell you, you know, it's like... you know, the trajectory of the bullet, you know, I figure it now, but the longer the range, the older the back sight, and the lower it is, or and the bullet goes up and over. You know, the more through practice and everything, you know, where the trail is or the path that they're going to get you to walk along, the more that the bullets are going to
go over your head.
Player, you know, but you don't know that. You know, when you're going flying, you're looking through some, you know, nobody has got that. Say, well, you know, that was a mile away from you, but you didn't have an idea. Now, when we went to this battle school in Korea, in Japan, we were told, well, it was like, you know, there were allowed so many casualties before there was any question from the Houses of Parliament. You know.
That would be quite shocking to learn.
Because of the fact that they were trying to get you so it wasn't hard, you know, you knew what you wanted.
We'll obviously come to that later. Was there anybody else with you during this little 2 week period? Or was it just your training unit there?
Well, it was like our Sean and Salamanca together. You know, we were together. And the fortnight, when we came away, there would be another group going up, and then another group. You know, there would be somebody there at the camp all the time doing this training. And we were up there, you know. And that was it. And I know the last day we had a walk from the camp, went miles from the camp, you see it down to San Zenz and all the other there. It was kind of high place. And that was the final march, the final thing. And I can't remember getting any more, not really, but any, well, as I say, nowhere in the morning. And by the time you go in, and you've got something to eat, and you start cleaning your kit up for the next day, you don't feel like one out. You just flop down on the, you know, I don't know what television says. I don't know if you caught the radios then. I don't know whether the Matthew player. It was really
pretty bleak.
Pretty bleak, you know. But, you just can't really sacked out like them.
You mentioned before, and I hadn't mentioned it earlier, about Korea. Did you know at this time that you would be going to Korea?
Yeah.
Can you remember when you found out?
Found out at Bransworth.
At Bransworth.
Yeah. Found out that that's where we're going now.
So was this training geared in particular for you going to Korea?
So. Yeah. And possibly the lads here in the Corries and we're going to Malaya. The trainer might have been a little bit different because of the terrain that they wanted. It would still be to get them hardened up on that, you know. But there might have been a little bit of difference in the trainer.
So I guess it was quite hilly up on the moors.
Aye. Plenty of valleys and big, deers, like what the deers are.
Looking back from when you got to Korea, what was. Was it similar?
No, it was entirely different.
What about the kinds of things that they taught you, though? Was that relevant?
Of course it was. The patrolling and that, you know. Obviously. We also saw that when we were at... I think we did the 2-inch mortar. It's just like a plumber piece of 2-inch pipe. And you drop a water bomb in, and there's a little thing at the bottom, and you pull a little cord, and the water bomb goes flying out.
Who used that weapon? Was that a company sort of level weapon?
Every platoon had them.
So it was a platoon?
It was a platoon weapon, aye. It was only about that long.
So what, run about 3 or 4 feet long?
Two inch mortar, and the bomb was 2 inch, and you used to, say, 45 degrees was its maximum trajectory, as far as distance it would fire. And of course, if you were flying over the hill, you pulled it back that way, so it went
higher trajectory,
or if you could go lower, the distance would be the same. Well, it was all just hit you missing, you just had to, that's as far as it would go on there. And every time it used to fight, the base used to sink into the soil if it was soft. And I think there was somebody had to carry the 2-inch mortar, and then somebody else had to carry the bombs, and the bombs were, maybe carry 5 bombs or something. It was sort of a rack or something.
And this was a general introduction to the 2-inch mortar, was it? And everybody
had a go at it. Yeah, and hand grenades, throw hand grenades as well. I think at Strensel, we might have thrown dummy hand grenades. That's the old life one, I don't know, but the fire and deals. That's where it cost us plenty of space. It's only cheap. Get out of the way and see what damage you're going to do.
What was the selection for personnel to use the 2-inch mortar? Was there any selection?
Everybody had one. It was like, nobody wanted to carry it, there was something else to carry. The brain gun was was heavy to carry, but there was a man designated to be the band gun, so he had the hood of the band gun. But everybody,
and that was at a platoon,
it was a level section, weapon.
Section weapon.
And everybody in the section had to carry magazines for the band gun. Because it fired the same 2 or 3 but rifle. And I think it's probably got those 32 rounds in a band gun magazine clipped on the top. And the whole section would carry magazines, full magazines. And of course, you get a 2-inch mortar, somebody had to carry a 2-inch mortar, and somebody had to carry mortar bombs as well. You know, you're quite laden down like with ammunition and gear, you know. But I never fired it in Korea like a 2-inch mortar. In fact, I never found it in a fire hole.
So you didn't have any experience in Korea? Well, obviously we'll come on later on, but you can't remember using it in Korea. We were obviously had that in mind when the when you were doing the training.
When it was a mobile war, possibly the were using, but we were static, you see.
Was it quite mobile? I mean, it was obviously quite a heavy thing to carry around.
No, it was only a pipe, a 2-inch pipe. You know, obviously hollow down the middle, in the little base at the bottom, with a trigger in, and that was it. It wasn't. It was. But was actually you're carrying a mandolin and heavy as a 50 rounds for your rifle. You're carrying a 9-pound rifle. You might have a couple of grenades. You've got some brand gun magazines. You're quite weighted down. A water bottle full of water. Your small pack on. You don't want anything extra. Everybody's shed the load.
Anything else? Just talking about weapons. Anything else that you can remember? We mentioned the rifle and the bayonet, hand grenades, Bren gun, mortars. Anything else that you can remember?
I'm fine, but I don't know where the 3.5 rocket launcher.
Was that at Strensel
it
or?
It would be at Strensel. It wasn't.
It wasn't in your 2 weeks. It would be.
Possibly. It might have been Hong Kong. I'm not sure. It might have been Hong Kong, but I did fire practice. You know, I mean, we're alive. Well, we have 3.5 rocket launcher.
Well, and the tank.
The Pierce. I never fired that. It was. I never saw anybody firing on one. But we were told how to do it. You had to. You put a blank in your rifle, and like this paint thing, you put it over the muzzle, and then you dig the rifle butt in and fire the blank, and the blank is still send it. The paint like a bomb. But the time but once again, like it's hitting this, and you're not aiming, you're just guessing.
But you can't remember actually firing one?
No, no. But it was another anti tank weapon which was available, but we never. We never did them. I say it maybe once again because it was a static war, and we didn't have any. Why it wasn't tank country? Is that good?
Just going back. There's 2 weeks. You came back to Strensel after that.
Aye.
What other things were you carrying on with at Strensel when you got back?
Well, we more or less got embarkation leave.
So this was towards the end of the year.
There was no passing out period. It was just, you did this training and went back. And then I think we were just like embarkation leave and you sail on such and such a day.
Was that how it worked for everybody? Was this 2 weeks more or less at the end of their 8 weeks?
Well, you see, it was a culmination of all the training that they'd given you for the rifles shooting at the targets down on the ranges, for the theory which they told you about how they get if the gun stops, if the gun stops firing, the procedures that you go through for, light goes out, you see the last one. You have the first, second, third eye, you know, what you do on the ground gun, and you learn all that. And then you do a bit of practice shooting that stencil, but then you put it all into practice up on the firing deals.
Right.
And there, they would tell you to strip a brain gun in the night time. You'd be out on the moors and say, right, strip it down and clean it in the dark. Come back again. It was like the culmination of.
So you'd had all the theory and all,
you've done,
and the practice, but this was the final.
This was the implementation of what they taught you. The little bit of practice that they had down there, and that was it.